Welcome to this special edition of the Golden Age of Radio on WMKY 90.3 FM. I'm your host, Paul Hitchcock. On this program, a reflection on the death of Franklin D. Roosevelt, who passed away on April 12, 1945. Through rare and vintage audio, news reports, and music, an historical perspective on the death of Franklin D. Roosevelt, the 32nd President of the United States. Stay tuned for the Golden Age of Radio. After today's news from NPR, on WMKY at 90.3 FM. Welcome back to the Golden Age of Radio on WMKY at 90.3 FM. I'm your host, Paul Hitchcock. On this special program of the Golden Age of Radio, a reflection on the death of Franklin D. Roosevelt, who passed away on April 12, 1945. Using rare and vintage audio, news reports, and music, we'll hear an historical perspective on the passing of Franklin D. Roosevelt, the 32nd President of the United States. Right now, from 1945, here are the Pied Pipers with Paul Weston and his orchestra as WMKY presents the Golden Age of Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Fulton Lewis, Jr. speaking from the Mutual Studios in New York City. This nation has suffered this day a staggering loss. At this moment at Warm Springs, Georgia, President Franklin D. Roosevelt lies with the problems of the nation finally lifted from his shoulders, stricken late this afternoon with cerebral hemorrhage. He passed away before his physicians could be of any assistance, if assistance in such a case is possible at all. Vice President Harry Truman, who from here on will be President Truman, went immediately to the White House. A special cabinet meeting was called, and we should know more about what is going to happen in Washington as the evening wears on. But Franklin D. Roosevelt, the first president to be elected for four terms in the White House, has passed away, and that is the overshadowing of all news events that have happened or can happen for quite a while.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin from CBS World News. A press association has just announced that President Roosevelt is dead. The president died of a cerebral hemorrhage. All we know so far is that the president died at Warm Springs in Georgia.
This is Don Fisher speaking to you again from Warm Springs, Georgia. This small southern community, which has been linked often with the name of the late President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, is wrapped tonight in the deepest shrouds of mourning. News of the humanitarian president's passing, which came so suddenly here this afternoon, has brought sincere grief to the hearts of these Georgians who had come to know him so well in his visits here during his tenure of the presidency. Here tonight is Mr. Fred Botts, registrar of the Warm Springs Foundation, a long acquaintance of Mr. Roosevelt's, who will express the feelings of those here in Warm Springs. Mr. Botts.
We, the patients, were inexpressibly shocked when hearing of our great leader's passing. Words are so futile at a time like this that we can only bow our heads, mingling our grief with the rest of the nation. Yet, we know it was and is his wish that we carry on and forward the great work he started here. He will still be our great inspiration. His spirit will live in our hearts always, as it did yesterday and the day before when he moved in our midst, guiding, directing, and cheerfully urging us on to overcome our infantile paralysis handicaps. We will prove our worth as his memory keeps company with our hearts. Hearts now wounded, but tomorrow strong in the faith to achieve the goal he set for us.
Thank you very much, Mr. Botts. Among the members of the press who were in Warm Springs today were the representatives of the three great wire services of America, Mr. Merriman Smith of the United Press, Mr. Harold Oliver of the Associated Press, and Mr. Robert Nixon of the International News Service. First, I'll call Mr. Merriman Smith over to the microphone. Mr. Smith is a past president of the White House Correspondents Association. Merriman, tell us about the occasion of the planned barbecue over at Mayor Allgorn's place this afternoon.
This was to have been a very happy day in the life of the president. He likes to be out with people. He likes to see new things. And this afternoon, on a small mountain just outside of Warm Springs, the mayor, Frank Allgorn, had a marvelous barbecue arranged. There were country fiddlers, and there were pigs and lambs roasting over an open pit. Big stew pot full of Brunswick stew. The president was supposed to be there at 4:30. Everybody was up there, the citizens of Warm Springs, few that knew about it. They were up there in their Sunday best. Some members of the president's party were there, too, waiting around. The president was supposed to arrive at 4:30. And about that time, the party hadn't shown up, so we telephoned to the little White House switchboard and got a hurry call to get right over there. And then's when the world first knew the news that Franklin D. Roosevelt had died.
Well, Merriman, tell us this. The reading public in America and the listening public have heard a great deal about the news and radio conferences at the White House, and the president has always been described as being a very affable person at those conferences. It is true, isn't it, that he not only had a great deal of fun with the members of the press as they attended those conferences, but they rather looked forward to them themselves, didn't they?
As a matter of practical fact, Don, he was God's gift to newspapermen. He produced more copy over the period of years that he was in the White House than any president in history.
Well, thank you very much, Merriman. Now here's Mr. Harold Oliver of the Associated Press. Harold, how many campaigns have you covered with the president?
I covered his whole second campaign, beginning in 1936, and part of his subsequent third and fourth campaigns.
And, of course, you got to know the president rather well, I imagine, in that space of time. What are, briefly, some of the highlights, some of the things that stand out in your mind as you covered those campaigns in 36 and 40 and now the most recent one in 44?
Well, the things that stood out in my mind more in the campaign travel was the hard trial on the physiques of those trying to keep up with the fast pace the president set. Especially that is true of the press service men who had to write 24 hours around the clock.
Well, there was quite a bit of mention last fall, if you remember, when he would get out in that open car on those cold days and ride through the city streets of Boston and New York to more or less enjoy seeing all the people along the parade route and have them enjoy seeing him too, isn't that right?
That is true, Don.
Well, what are the funeral plans as of right now, Harold?
The funeral plans, as we know them here, are very tentative and incomplete. However, we believe they have been announced in Washington, but so far as we know, they plan to take the body from here sometime tomorrow morning, probably beginning around 8 o'clock Central Time, which is on Warm Springs time.
And then they'll proceed on to
Washington.
Proceed
to Washington. It takes about 22 hours to get to Washington.
Well, thank you very much, Harold. I know that you, like all other newspaper and radio men, are rather sorry that this series of trips to Warm Springs seems to be nearing an end, because it's been a great pleasure to come down here to Warm Springs, not only to be in the president's party, but to mingle with the townspeople here.
Certainly.
Now, here's Bob Nixon of the International News Service. Bob, tell me, how has the president looked to you on this particular trip to Warm Springs?
Well, I'd rather preface it by saying this about Franklin Roosevelt. During the past 12 years, he has been called upon to bear burdens that perhaps no other man in history has ever had to bear. He bore up under them like perhaps no other man could bear. During the past year, he's failed rapidly. Coming down here from Washington on this trip, the president looked a little tired and worn. Perhaps no more so than he has for many months past. He had just come back, as you know, from the great conference at Yalta. He looked fine when he got back. He had had 2 weeks of beautiful sunshine on his voyage back home. And it's remarkable the recuperative powers that the president did have. At one time, he would look tired and worn. Then a few days of sunshine and rest, and he would look in great shape again. The past week or so, after his arrival here, he got out in the sun a great deal, and while he was thin and tired looking, his death today came very unexpectedly and a great shock to all.
I understand he used to get a great kick out of coming down to Warm Springs and after getting out of his railroad car, getting into his automobile and driving it on up to the foundation. Did he do that this trip?
He was a man who loved to do things and liked to do them himself. On this particular trip, mainly he drove around in an open car with his chauffeur.
What were his plans as to the San Francisco conference? I know he looked forward to going out there to officially open the conference. What were his plans, do you know? Was he going on to from Washington to San Francisco?
Yes, Don. One of the last things he did today before he died was to dictate the itinerary for his trip out to San Francisco. We were to leave here next week, stopping briefly in Washington, and then continuing on out to San Francisco, where he was to address the United Nations conference as the host.
Well, thank you very much, Bob. Ladies and gentlemen, we've presented Mr. Fred Botts, Registrar of the Warm Springs Foundation, a long acquaintance of President Roosevelt's. We've also presented members of the three wire services, Mr. Merriman Smith of United Press, Mr. Bob Nixon of International News Service, and Mr. Harold Oliver, of the Associated Press. Thank you very much, gentlemen, all of you, for coming down to the microphone tonight to give the American listening public an inside view of just how things have been in Warm Springs today. This is Don Fisher speaking now, and I return you to New York.
Robert Trout of CBS World News has spent many hours traveling with President Roosevelt during his long tenure in the White House. He has had opportunities unlike many others to see the president under various circumstances. Mr. Trout.
Tonight, the tributes are beginning to come in from the great and the small of the civilized world. There will be many sincere words of sorrow and respect, and there will be many tears, and most of them will come from the small, the unknown people, because, as another American wartime president, who also died before his task was done, once observed, there are so many more of the common people. Tonight, as the tributes and the recollections come in, it might not be out of place for me to add a few of my own recollections. Because I am a broadcaster, my memories of Franklin Roosevelt are almost exclusively concerned with the business of broadcasting. The president was known as an exceptionally able broadcaster. Many pages of prose were written analyzing his microphone style and technique, and students of politics have frequently attempted to evaluate the effect of Mr. Roosevelt's broadcasting talents on his political fortunes. But those whose business is not with broadcasting are not likely to remember that Franklin Roosevelt created much broadcasting history. He was the first world statesman to use the radio as a vital instrument of social power. He used it in a personalized fashion. His most famous talks were delivered in the style of an intimate conversation, which was enormously effective. He saw clearly the power of radio before many men in government had seen it. When Franklin Roosevelt was sworn in as President of the United States for the first time, it was not the fashion of world statesmen to take their problems to the people simply and directly by speaking to the people, millions of them at once, over the radio. In these few short years, it has now become so much the fashion that it's taken for granted and scarcely remarked upon. For now it is the custom for the heads of the greatest nations to make their most important pronouncements to all the world at once by radio. The day after Franklin Roosevelt's first inauguration, on Sunday, the 5th of March, 1933, he broadcast his first fireside chat. Tomorrow, the 13th of April, 1945, he was scheduled to broadcast from Warm Springs. At that first fireside chat, and at many of the presidential broadcasts that followed, I had the opportunity of being with the president. As a representative of the Columbia Broadcasting System, I introduced a large number of the White House broadcasts and traveled with the presidential party through most of the states of the Union to handle the broadcasts outside the White House. From the beginning, it was plain that Franklin Roosevelt understood radio. He was interested in the technical equipment and in the intricate arrangements often necessary when he addressed the nation from remote places, such as a lodge high in the Rocky Mountains, or the parapet of a newly completed dam, or from his car of the presidential train. After he'd been in office only a few months, other statesmen, other men in politics, in foreign countries as well as the United States, showed that they were learning the lesson that radio is the natural method for a statesman to use in communicating directly with the people. President Roosevelt's approach to the microphone was extremely natural, although he had different styles which he used when speaking from his desk or when addressing the radio audience over the heads of a great visible audience in an auditorium or a stadium. I've seen him take the microphone at a college gathering, intending to speak a sentence or two of thanks for an honorary degree, and then suddenly, seized with inspiration, deliver an extemporaneous address lasting half an hour. And I've seen him, upon arriving too early at a political rally, stand patiently at the rostrum for 45 minutes before beginning his speech until the scheduled time for the broadcast to start, and it was not easy for Franklin Roosevelt to stand. Once, as I was describing to Columbia's radio audience the approach of the president up the ramp to the speaker's platform at one of the largest political rallies of all, the braces on his legs gave way and he fell. The pages of his manuscript were scattered. They were picked up by willing hands and hurriedly handed back to the president, who by that time had been seated, now within view of the visible audience of many thousands. He put the pages together again as best he could in the few moments before he was introduced. The manuscript was damp, crumpled, and spattered with mud. It was a tense moment, and Mr. Roosevelt did not falter. Only a handful of the thousands in the stadium that night had the faintest idea that anything at all had gone wrong. That was the night the president, in a strong and confident voice, proclaimed, "This generation of Americans has a rendezvous with destiny." Many will remember that broadcast speech delivered at Franklin Field in Philadelphia at the end of the Democratic Convention of 1936. It was the president's acceptance speech for a second-term nomination, and if he had allowed the accident to upset him, if he had become unnerved by the prospect that the braces might fail again while he was speaking, the political history of this nation might have been changed. He was not unnerved. If Franklin Roosevelt ever was, those of us who form the body of journalists, of radio and press, who have covered his activities, have not been aware of it. Customarily, his hand shook as he stood before the crowd so often in so many cities and villages, but there was no tremor in his voice. It was calm and confident by nature. It was calm that very first day, on March the 4th, 1933, when, a few minutes after he became president of the United States, he told the millions waiting by their radios so anxiously, "We have nothing to fear but fear itself." Before broadcast time, Franklin Roosevelt sat calmly on a sofa talking to his old friend and advisor, Louis McHenry Howe. There had been a business conference in the offices of Columbia's Washington Station. And as a result of that meeting, Stephen Early, the president's secretary, was asked by telephone what he thought of a title Columbia had thought of for the president's talk. The suggested title was Fireside Chat. A bit later, Mr. Early telephoned back that the president thought the title was grand. It expressed just the kind of talk he intended to make. But there in the Lincoln study, a few minutes before the clock showed it was time for me to introduce to America for the first time the now famous phrase, fireside chat, a few minutes before airtime, it was discovered that the manuscript for the first fireside chat was missing. A search was made for the missing speech amidst great excitement, but one man was not touched by the excitement, Mr. Roosevelt. He was unperturbed and seemed perfectly satisfied when someone found a mimeographed press copy of the speech. It was not so easy a copy to read, especially to so large an audience at a time so tense. But the president used that copy when he spoke. His cigarette in the long ivory holder burned down nearly to the end as he talked on the air. I watched it in strained fascination, for in those days in Washington, radio reporters were not used to statesmen who felt so thoroughly at home before a microphone that they could stamp out a cigarette in an ashtray while broadcasting without pausing or stumbling. Later, of course, we grew used to the president's ease of manner, and it was no surprise one summer night in the White House, when Mr. Roosevelt's throat became dry as he spoke, to hear him casually interrupt his broadcast to ask for a glass of water, and after he had sipped it, say to the nationwide audience, "It's a hot night in Washington, my friends." Another night, the president exceeded his scheduled time on the air, and a clock on the mantel loudly chimed 10, which might have upset a broadcaster with less poise. But Franklin Roosevelt was not upset during that broadcast or any of the others when unplanned incidents occurred. Radio reporters, like me, were used to hearing the president call us by our first names and make little jokes at our expense. He loved to tease us about the speeches, as he would call them, speeches we were sometimes forced to make, when for some reason there was more time on the air than had been scheduled to fill with words before the president began. And he often joked about the fireside chats on hot summer nights in Washington when a refrigerator would have been more comfortable than a fire. There were many strange and often moving sights to be seen on the presidential trips across the country year after year. From the beginning, the people came to see and to listen. When he could, the president spoke to them from the rear platform of his railroad car, which was equipped with a microphone. The baggage car of the presidential train carried the complicated microphone stand, which Columbia presented to Mr. Roosevelt on his first inauguration day, and which was used in the formal addresses at stops along the way. Often in the middle of the night, speeding through open farm country, or perhaps through the desert, some of the reporters aboard the train who had stayed up late would look out the window. And there, almost always, over the miles and through the days, were the silent crowds. Farmers, shopkeepers, miners, fishermen, factory workers, desert rats. They rode in their battered cars or drove their horses or walked, for no one knows how many hours, to stand beside the tracks in the middle of the dark night and watch the president's train speed by. It seemed to satisfy them, as nearly as we could ever tell, just to stand there and look, or perhaps wave a handkerchief or a hat. Once in the rugged country of Idaho, we'd roared along in the train for many miles without seeing a house or a man. Suddenly, the train raced out from between the tall trees and ran beside a quiet mountain lake. There, on a tiny homemade pier beside his log cabin, stood a man, a trapper or a fisherman or a hunter, perhaps, standing on his little pier between two large American flags he'd rigged up, standing at attention with his hand in a military salute at his forehead as the train sped past. He'd made his arrangements, put up his decorations, and he greeted the train for the few moments it was visible to him. Millions of people all over the world will remember Franklin Roosevelt in some particular attitude or pose. Millions who've never seen him will keep in their minds the memory of his smile, perhaps, or his cheerful radio greeting, "My friend." Naturally, my own memory picture will be one in which Franklin Roosevelt was doing what I've seen him do so often, speaking into a microphone to all the people of this country and to all men of goodwill everywhere. There are many such mental pictures that come to me tonight. Perhaps it's not possible to choose deliberately the one I should prefer to remember. But if I am allowed a choice, I should like to remember always the Capitol steps in Washington, crowded with those who were tormented by worry, and the new president of the United States, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, saying to those people and to the millions beyond the Capitol at home by their radios, saying, "We have nothing to fear but fear itself."
Like a child in wild anticipation, long to hear that all aboard. 7, that's the time we leave at 7. I'll be waiting up at heaven, counting every mile of railroad that takes me back. Never thought my heart could be so yearning. Why did I decide to roam? Gotta take that sentimental journey, sentimental journey home. Sentimental journey.
You are listening to The Golden Age of Radio on WMKY, featuring an historical perspective on the passing of Franklin D. Roosevelt, who passed away on April 12, 1945. We heard Les Brown and his orchestra with Doris Day singing Sentimental Journey. We also heard a CBS report with Don Fisher and Robert Trout from April 12, 1945, Fulton Lewis's announcement on the Mutual Broadcasting System, and the Pied Piper sang Dream featuring Paul Weston and his orchestra. I'm Paul Hunchcock, and this is the Golden Age of Radio on WMKY at 90.3 FM. Paul Hunchcock, and you're listening to a special edition of the Golden Age of Radio on WMKY at 90.3 FM. On this special program, a reflection on the death of Franklin D. Roosevelt, who passed away on April 12, 1945. Right now, here's an original CBS broadcast of the memorial service first broadcast on radio on April 13, 1945, as WMKY presents the Golden Age of Radio.
Here in Chicago, a vast multitude of men, women, and children of all ages have gathered to pay their reverent, simple, and sincere respects at a special service being held in the sanctuary of the Chicago Historic Temple from which we are speaking to you now. Located in the very heart of the famous Loop, Chicago's business district, this place of worship is one of the oldest in Chicago, the church having been located on the present site for 106 years. The service today, which began at 3 o'clock Chicago time, is being conducted under the joint auspices of the First Methodist Church and the Church Federation of Greater Chicago, comprising some 1,200 churches and 22 denominations. Participating in this memorial service in honor of Franklin Delano Roosevelt are Dr. Charles Ray Goff, pastor of the First Methodist Church, and Dr. Harold W. Roop, pastor of the Central Church in Chicago's Loop, and president of the Church Federation of Greater Chicago. Specially selected hymns and religious music will be sung by a quartet and played by the church organist. The service will be Episcopalian, since that was Mr. Roosevelt's denomination. For over a century now, rich and poor alike have come to pray and worship in this sanctuary beneath the spire, which rises 568 feet above the street, making it, I'm told, the tallest church in the world. Unlike most houses of worship, the Chicago Temple is not a building apart, but shares its structure with many business offices, the church itself occupying the lower three floors. Its construction is soundproof, however, so that the noise from the outside business world all about it is completely shut out. The overall architecture of the church is French Gothic, and there's much more to tell about this historic sanctuary, but I'd like to take a minute or so now to tell you something about this service and the people who have come to pay their humble respects. Long before the service began, people began to file silently into the sanctuary, singly, in couples, and in larger groups. In a short time, the church was filled to capacity, and long lines had formed outside on the street. Almost without exception, there was no conversation. People who came together, members of the same family, close friends, suddenly became strangers to all appearances. Somehow, idle conversation seemed terribly out of place. In the faces of all, one could read the personal grief that each felt and sensed that he just didn't care to talk about it or about anything else at the moment. The congregation, as you might expect, includes just about every type of individual who bears the name American. From my vantage point, I can see two Negro soldiers sitting in silence, their arms folded across their chests. In the pew ahead of them, a young Chinese woman sits with a little girl held close in her arms. The sailor idly fingers his hat perched on his knees. An old man beside him rests his chin on his cane. Men and women who have finished their shift at one of Chicago's war plants and are on their way home have stopped to take part in the service. A policeman sits in rapt attention. Scattered throughout are men and women of means who have perhaps come down from the well-to-do Gold Coast district on the near north side. Army, Navy, Coast Guard, and Marine uniforms are quite evident in every pew. Members of the women's branch of the services are well represented. I talked to a few of the people as they entered the sanctuary earlier through the huge bronze doors. I was seeking some personal reason why they had come in when it would have been so easy to pass by. One man said he couldn't explain it, but he was on his way to meet a friend at the Union Station when he saw the line of people gathering outside the temple. Something seemed to draw him inside to pay his respects to. He hoped his friend's train would arrive late enough for him to meet it after the service, but he wasn't too concerned about it. This is the kind of thing that upsets everybody's plans, he said simply. When I asked a young member of the Air Force if he could tell me why he had decided to attend this memorial service, he had a ready answer. I always pray when a friend of mine passes on, he replied. And I can't think of any other one man who was a friend to more people in this world than Mr. Roosevelt. Can you? I said I couldn't. For the past few minutes, we've been trying to draw a word picture of the special service being held in honor of Franklin Delano Roosevelt here in the sanctuary of the Chicago Temple, located in the very heart of the Loop Business District. Russ Davis speaking. We take you now to Kansas City. Gene Dennis reporting.
This is Gene Dennis in Kansas City. Sorrowing throngs from Kansas City and nearby Independence, Missouri, home of President Harry S. Truman, are gathered in Kansas City's beautiful municipal auditorium. This same auditorium was dedicated by our late President, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, in a great civic ceremony, October 13th, 1936. Now, today, many of the same people who first saw the President here that day 8.5 years ago return to the arena of the auditorium to pay deepest, heartfelt respects to his memory in these solemn ceremonies. In the background, you hear the concert orchestra under the direction of Sigmund Romberg, Victoria Schuhl singing The Rosary. The platform of the arena is set in a scene befitting the acknowledged preference of our late president. A beautiful woodland scene enlivened with huge sprays of flowers and greenery woven into the lifelike background. In the very center of the setting, framed in a garland of American beauty roses, is a portrait of Mr. Roosevelt. Over it hangs the American flag. Along the front of the platform, and in huge banks to both sides, are beautiful bouquets of flowers, hydrangeas, lilies, and snapdragons, lending themselves to the setting that seems to whisper the reverence of this occasion. This great hall, scene of a myriad of civic events, has been transformed into a giant cathedral. The some 12,000 worshipers who come here today remove their hats as they approach the canopy overhanging the 13th Street entrance. Quietly, respectfully, they have now filed to their seats. And now, from the floor seats and the seats of the circular arena, they gaze down, almost to a man, at the portrait of our late president. What their thoughts are, we of course can't tell. Their grief is mirrored in their faces as we mark the passing of this great humanitarian. Doubtlessly, to many of them, there come thoughts of the tremendous responsibilities that have come to a fellow townsman and neighbor, Harry S. Truman. President Truman's home is in nearby Independence, Missouri. And hundreds of the people in Kansas City and Jackson County who are attending these ceremonies here today are intimately acquainted with our new president. We have known him as a farmer, a Kansas City businessman, a county judge, United States senator, briefly as vice president, and now as chief executive in this most critical era of mankind's history. As we pay our last respects to the memory of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, so do we pray that God will give President Harry S. Truman the strength to carry on the great work that lies ahead of him. His Missouri friends are thinking of him today. The music you hear is Sigmund Romberg conducting the concert orchestra playing Handel's Largo. Because the Roosevelt family worships in the faith of the Episcopal Church, these Kansas City memorial services are being conducted by one of that faith, Bishop Robert Nelson Spencer of the Episcopal Church. He is being assisted by outstanding Kansas City clergymen of all faiths, creeds, and races. Truly, this is a ceremony that we believe our late president would want, for it speaks of the democracy he gave his life to preserve. These Kansas City memorial services have included such music as Schubert's Unfinished Symphony, The Rosary, and Handel's Largo. The congregation will join to sing Near My God to Thee, Crossing the Bar, and Faith of Our Fathers. The services were opened by Kansas City's Mayor, John D. Gage, who delivered brief remarks concerning the president's service to our nation. This is Gene Dennis speaking from radio station KMBC in Kansas City's Municipal Auditorium, scene of the Heart of America's memorial service to the late President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. We take you now to Dallas, Dick Bush reporting.
While Dallas in the Southwest pauses this afternoon in reverent respect to the memory of a great man, CBS microphones have been set up in St. Matthew's Cathedral Episcopal in Dallas in order to bring you a part of the memorial service for the late President Roosevelt, which is now in progress. This is one of many services now being held throughout the nation as American people draw near to their churches as they have done so often in these years of war. And now they have come to their places of worship to pay memory to a great man. The service is already in progress here in St. Matthew's. The people have filed in with deep reverence and with great respect for the occasion. Now seated in the sanctuary, the choir is preparing to sing the anthem, Souls of the Righteous by Sir Edgar Elgar. We take you now to the chancel of St. Matthew's Cathedral so that you might hear a portion of this anthem as it is sung by the choir. The choir is under the direction of Henry W. Sanderson, choirmaster and organist of St. Matthew's. And now to the chancel of St. Matthew's Cathedral for the choir singing a portion of the anthem, Souls of the Righteous by Sir Edgar Elgar. Here in St. Matthew's Cathedral in Dallas, we will describe briefly for you the service that has taken place this afternoon. The service here in St. Matthew's in Dallas opened as the cathedral choir moved up the aisle to the chancel, with Dean Gerald G. Moore reading the opening sentences. Upon reaching the chancel, the magnificent strains of the hymn, O God, Our Help in Ages Past, were sung by the choir, followed by the singing of the burial psalms, which express such thoughts as, God is our hope and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore will we not fear, though the earth be moved and though the hills be carried into the midst of the sea. Be still then, and know that I am God. The scripture lesson read by Father Richard A. Hayes, assistant at St. Matthew's, the triumphant words of Paul's letter to the Romans echoed through the sanctuary. For I am persuaded that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor principalities, nor powers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor height, nor depth, nor any other creature shall be able to separate us from the love of God, which is in Christ Jesus, our Lord. Just before the beginning of our broadcast, the choir sang the late president's favorite hymn, "How Firm a Foundation, Ye Saints of the Lord, is laid for your faith in his excellent word. What more can he say then to you than he hath said, you who unto Jesus for refuge have fled? Fear not, I am with thee. Oh, be not dismayed. I am thy God, and will still give thee aid. I'll strengthen thee, help thee, and cause thee to stand, upheld by my righteous, omnipotent hand." And now we have the choir singing in the chancel of St. Matthew's the triumphant anthem, "Souls of the Righteous," by Sir Edgar Elgar, under the direction of Henry W. Sanderson, choirmaster and organist. After our broadcast, Bishop Harry T. Moore of the Dallas Diocese of the Episcopal Church will make the remarks in this occasion, as churches all over the nation are so doing, as they have paused to pay respect to the president while services are going on in the White House. And now we take you to the chancel where Bishop Moore, or rather Dean Moore, will give the closing prayers.
Remember thy servant Franklin Delano, O Lord, according to the favor which thou bearest unto thy people, and grant that increasing in knowledge and love of thee, he may go from strength to strength in the life of perfect service in thy heavenly kingdom, through Jesus Christ our Lord, who liveth and reigneth with thee in the Holy Ghost, ever one God, world without end.
You have been listening to services being broadcast from St. Matthew's Cathedral here in Dallas, conducted by Dean Gerald B. Moore of this church.
We take you now to Hyde Park, Tris Coffin reporting.
I stood by the grave in the bright sunlight of a cool spring morning as the last mortal remains of Franklin Delano Roosevelt were laid at rest. The plaintive notes of taps rang out over a hushed gathering of relatives, friends, and officials at the Roosevelt family estate. The services were held in the T-shaped garden only a few yards from the president's study. A high hedge shielded the burial. The rose bushes laid out in neat plots were in bud. Clusters of violets spotted the carpet of green lawn. The sky overhead was clear blue. The gathering was small and hushed by mutual understanding. There were many famous faces, but they were all blurred by the common denominators of solemnness and sorrow. Mrs. Roosevelt and Anna Roosevelt Bodiger were dressed in black. They stood with General Elliott Roosevelt. President and Mrs. Truman were with Mr. Roosevelt's intimate advisor, Justice Burns. I saw many old friends of the president: Jim Farley, Steve Early, Bernard Baruch, the cabinet, military high command, Supreme Court, and members of Congress. Mrs. James Roosevelt, the elderly cousin of the president, sat in a chair on the lawn. At her feet in the warm sunlight was Fala, Mr. Roosevelt's dog. The services began with the firing of a 21-gun salute. The only sound in the 10-second intervals between salvos was the chirping of a thrush high in the trees. In the distance, I heard the mournful sound of muffled drums. The coffin and its military escort were moving down the road. The band began to softly play the sad, majestic strains of Massenet's Elegy. A child cried at the strange music. Through a gate in the hedge, I saw the guard of honor from West Point, young, sober faces, marching in slow, measured steps. The band changed to the Star-Spangled Banner, and then the soft, comforting chords of "Nearer, My God, to Thee." The coffin was borne in by soldiers, preceded by a choir boy holding a golden crucifix. The Reverend W. George Anthony, rector of the Episcopal Church at Hyde Park, read the burial services. His snow-white hair was blown by the wind. His words at times were carried away. I heard these snatches. I heard a voice from heaven: "Our Father who art in heaven, grant him entrance into the land of light and joy. We give thee hearty thanks for the good example of thy servants. Dust to dust and earth to earth." The voice ceased. 11 cadets from West Point pointed their rifles into the air and fired 3 volleys. The crash of sound echoed for seconds. The flag was removed from the coffin and handed to Mrs. Roosevelt. The coffin was lowered gently into the ground. Franklin Roosevelt was at rest in his beloved gardens. The thrush was singing again. I return you to New York.
long as stars are in the blue, long as there's a spring, a bird to sing, I'll go on loving you till the end of time. Long as roses bloom in May, my love for you will grow deeper with every passing day, till the wells run dry and each mountain disappears. I'll be there for you to care for you through laughter and through tears. So take my heart in sweet surrender and tenderly say that I'm the one you love and live for till the end of time. Till the wells run dry and each mountain disappears, I'll be there for you to care for you through laughter and through tears. So take my heart in sweet surrender and tenderly say that I'm the one and live for till the end of time.
The Golden Age of Radio on WMKY, featuring Russ Case and his orchestra, with Perry Como singing Till the End of Time. We also heard CBS's broadcast of Memorial Service's first broadcast on radio on April 13, 1945. You've been listening to An Historical Perspective on the passing of Franklin D. Roosevelt, the 32nd President of the United States, who passed away on April 12, 1945. Material for this program provided by the Internet Archive, an online nonprofit library of books, movies, music, and old-time radio shows, on the web at archive.org. I'm Paul Hitchcock. Thanks for listening to this special program of the Golden Age of Radio on WMKY at 90.3 FM and online at WMKY.org.